Hi, I'm Robert Osborne. Thanks so much for joining me for TCM's Private Screenings Uncut. Chance for you to listen to the complete conversations from our TCM archives with guests who've appeared on our private screening shows over the years. Now, typically when I do one of these private screenings interviews, I talk for a couple of hours, maybe more, with the guests, but only an hour or less of that material makes it into the final show. Well, with Private Screenings Uncut, you can hear the entire talk as it occurred. And this month's Private Screenings Uncut is the talk I had with bubbly, upbeat, and unsinkable Debbie Reynolds in 2002. Debbie's life has been loaded with high points, but also enough low points to justify cynicism and caution to set in. But as you'll hear in this interview, Debbie's made it her mission in life to always find a bright side, always pick herself up, move on, and live life to the fullest. Quite a life it's been, too. She was born in El Paso, Texas, but moved with her family to California at the age of 7 when her father found himself out of work. Well, even as a kid, Debbie was never idle. And in her teens, she won a beauty contest by doing an impression of Betty Hutton, and that brought her to the attention of movie scouts. It wasn't long until she was under contract to the Tiffany of movie studios, MGM, and on her way to becoming a famous star, something she never actually aspired to be. And in the interview, she talks about the profession she really wanted to pursue. Debbie also gives her full account of how she ended up in the film she's most famous for today, the great musical Singin' in the Rain, and also the valuable lessons she learned from her co-star in that movie, Gene Kelly. She also talks about what she learned from such legends as Fred Astaire and Frank Sinatra. Debbie also discusses her very public marriage to singer Eddie Fisher and the embarrassment when that union fell apart after Elizabeth Taylor came into their lives. It was her deep family roots that got her through that episode, and she talks about that. Also about daughter Carrie Fisher and son Todd Fisher, and the making of her films Tammy and the Bachelor, The Unsinkable Molly Brown, and others. So here, originally recorded in 2002 and brought to you for the first time ever in its uncut form, TCM's Private Screenings Uncut, Debbie Reynolds.
Hi there, Robert.
Hi, Debbie. Thank you for being here.
I'm happy to be here.
You once said that you were the least likely star in show business. Why do you say that?
Well, it's just such a surprise, isn't it, that I would wind up in show business. No one in my family's in show business. And for this to have happened in my life, rather really to give me life, because I just love the business. And I think because I was always a little energetic and perhaps just a little crazier than other kids, I just fit right in, because show business has a lot of crazy people in it. When I don't like the term crazy, but let's say unusual and out there and funny, or, you know, wanting to have a good time. And that's sort of me. I'm high-spirited. And as a kid, I was in the principal's office every day. And my poor mother. My mother always said she thought I was twins because I talked so much and that I was so rowdy. And I got into so much trouble, just mischievous, you know, climb the flagpole, steal the boys' shoes and throw them out the window, little things like that. But they always beat me up, so.
When did you think of yourself as being a success in show business?
Well, I think I'm a success. When that word success, you know, I've had this wonderful job now, 53 years. Success is a word when you have achieved and when you've worked a long time and you've really lasted. Star, people ask me about that, I never think I'm a star. I think that I'm a very hard worker, and God was good to me and gave me a comedic talent, and I've studied very hard and seriously about my acting, because in order to do true comedy, you have to be a good dramatic actress, which when I was young, I didn't really pay attention to or give credence to as much. But around 28, when they put me into Mary Mary, the Gene Kerr play, Mr. Warner, and I wanted to get out of it because I really wanted Barbara Bel Geddes to do it. She did it on Broadway, and she was so brilliant. Why am I doing this? You know, I said to Jack Warner, he said, you're doing it because I'm telling you you're doing it, Debbie. So I went to study very, very seriously with Lillian Burns Sidney, the coach at Metro, and she really worked hard with me on my dramatic abilities, you know, such as how to really find the role and the character, and then be able to really do it well, crying and dramatic scenes.
But you'd already done some dramatic things like Catered Affair and The Rat Race. I mean, really unusual things by then. Why then did you think you needed to go to a coach?
Well, Barry Nelson and the entire cast were from Broadway. They had been playing on Broadway for 2 to 3 years, very successfully, and their timing was so perfect. And in walks this newcomer, and certainly I wasn't that their team, you know. And so I had to fit in, and I had to be as good as they, who had been doing this part for 3 years, and I just felt that I wasn't. And so that's why I think I felt so insecure. Yes, I felt at home in Rat Race because I knew Tony Curtis, and we always got along really great, and Don Rickles. And so I felt very comfortable, whereas in the other roles, I didn't feel comfortable. I finally did, but I worked really hard on that one.
Let's go back to the beginning. You started out in Burbank, California, a little girl there, and you entered a Miss Burbank contest.
In 1948, Daddy brought us from Texas because we were really poor, and he just thought that we weren't ever going to get above that there. And he wanted us to have a better life. What a great little guy. If you could think about a hero in your life, it's my dad. He lived in the park, didn't eat, just slept in the park, saving his money to bring us from Texas. And he worked for the railroad, so we got a chair car, whatever that's called. And we came out with a little sandwich bag, and Daddy and Mother, we all starved for a couple of years.
How old were you at this point?
I was seven. So it was wonderful for my father to have. Why did he have that vision? I just can't even get over it, because he was an uneducated fellow. You know, he didn't have a chance to go to school. And, well, he went to very beginning school, but his dad beat him up, and he had a rough childhood, my father. And so he wanted a really better life, and boy, did he give it to us. My brother, as you know, was a makeup artist for all the years. He just retired about 9 years ago. And he did all the Beverly Hillbillies and lots of movies, and Lana Turner and Ava Gardner. And, you know, so he's very talented. We've had a wonderful life because Daddy moved us. Now, maybe we would have had a wonderful life in Texas, but we sure would have had to scrounge around. You know, not that living in Texas is poor. It's just the circumstances for our family were quite poor at the time.
Now, when you were getting sent to the principal's office and doing these little things you were doing, did you have any inclinations toward show business then? I mean, was that ever anything that crossed your mind?
No, I used to entertain just for fun because I was a big ham. I still am a big ham. And I liked the Elks Club and the Boys and Girl Scout places, you know, they'd have jamborees, and I would do a little record impression of Betty Hutton. You and I were talking about Betty Hutton a moment ago, whom I love because she was that rowdy personality, and I liked that. I sort of thought, you know, I'm like her thing. And I used to do record impressions of Betty at these different events, and some of the Red Skelton sketches he used to do, a woman driver that always put her arm out to turn left and would go right. And I liked to do pantomime, and as a child, I would do little plays and things for the neighborhood. So I guess it was in there. I think you're born with a love to entertain.
So the Miss Burbank contest came along. Why did you enter it? And
well, that's just like every community, I think, has a Miss Burbank, Miss New Jersey, or Miss Atlantic City or something. And so Miss Burbank, I entered for a free blouse and scarf because they gave that to you. You didn't have to win because I knew I wouldn't win because I'm short, as you know. And I certainly thought you had to be very tall and very, and I thought, well, naturally, that's not going to be me. So I went out there just acting silly. I didn't want to go. I signed up to go. And my mother, the night of the contest, I didn't want to go, so because I didn't want to embarrass myself. And my mother said, well, did you sign up? Didn't you take the blouse and scarf? And I said, yes. And she said, well, you have to go. That you gave your word, so you have to be there. So my bathing suit had a hole in the rear end, so my mother darned up my hole in the rear end. I still have that bathing suit. And then I had no high heels, so because we still didn't have very much money, so a girlfriend loaned me some high heels, but they were too hard. Who could walk in those things? I said, women are crazy. I'm not. So I took them, I carried them. So I walked out and paraded around in my bathing suit barefoot. And then I did the record impression, and a young man that was a good friend of mine at school, because I didn't date, the boys didn't want to date me. My name was Franny, and I was a real tomboy. So he brought a record player, the kind that you want, wound up, you know. And then I put the record out, and I did the record impression, and I won the contest. I think they thought that I was so amusing or something. That started it in 1948. There were two talent scouts there, one from Warner's and one from MGM. See, that's the wonderful thing years ago, what they had, talent scouts all over, out in Iowa and anywhere. A young person had a better chance than today. You have to break in through television. You don't have that chance. But they flipped a coin, and Warner Brothers, the Al Trosconi was his name, they took me over there. I'd never been inside that studio. You know, I always thought it looked like a prison because there was a big tall walls and the gate and everything. I used to drive. We'd walk by it. I lived right near Warner Brothers, so I'd ride my bicycle by. And I did a test, and they asked me, why did I want to be a movie star? And I said, well, I don't. I'm in school, and I'm working for a scholarship to be a gym teacher. And they thought that was pretty silly and pretty funny that I didn't want to be in the movies. So Mr. Warner liked the test, and he put me under contract for $65 a week. And I used to catch the bus and still go back to my school because I had to do 3 hours of schooling on the lot, which I thought was so boring. I was the only student. You can't cheat.
The only one in the class.
Yeah, you can't cheat. I had nobody to copy. So
so you did a couple of parts. June Bride, I remember, and Daughter of Rosie O'Grady.
That was like an extra. You know, they weren't big parts. But I had a wonderful time because at the time, Betty Davis was still there. And she was doing a movie. I can't remember the name of it. And they were doing a kissing scene. And they used to let me sneak. She had close sets. And so they were the big rafters, you know, the overhead, I forget what they call them now, grids. Uh-huh. And the workers were up there with all the lights. So I would sneak up there, and I was looking down at Betty Davis kissing Robert Montgomery. And I'm leaning over, and Miss Davis is kissing him, and she opened her eyes, and she saw me. She said, what is that? This is a closed set. She was so furious. I ran so fast. I jumped down those ladders. I leapt over everything. I was out of that door like a thief. I never told her that story when I worked with her because I thought she'd be mad at me. It was me watching her kissing Robert Montgomery. I was very thrilled to be at that studio.
So now, by this time, were you kind of maybe getting ambitious about doing all
this? No. I wanted to go to school and be a gym teacher. But Mr. Warner wasn't going to make any more musicals, so he called Sally Biano, the other talent scout at Metro, and he said, the kid's available. So Mr. Sally Biano, who was a talent scout at Metro, drove me over in his Cadillac. I'll never forget that. And sitting in a Cadillac. Oh, I was such a thrill being in a Cadillac because we had an old 1932 Chevy and the door fell off. So we get to MGM and I did a little movie called Three Little Words. And they just wanted a little part that would sing, I want to be loved by you, boo, boo, be doo. So that was what I did there. And actually, it was her voice. I just did the record impression.
Helen Kane.
She was, in the silent screen.
So it's actually a big movie, but little part.
Little part, you know, one song.
Knocked everybody out when they saw it.
Yeah, they liked it. They thought I was funny and cute, and I was, after all, you know, I was 17 then. It all started when I was 16. And then Mr. Mayer said, put the kid under contract. And they signed me for $300 a week. Whoa, my father said, this is crazy. Why would they put you under contract? You're not even pretty. I said, because they're crazy. I don't know, Daddy. What do we care? It's $300 a week. I'll get to go to college. Oh, that's true. Well, do the best you can. And later on, you can get a good job. So I've been doing this good job for quite a long time.
So then you went into, I believe, Three Little Words? No,
Two Weeks with Love with Janie Powell. You know, in those days, Robert, they would create you. Like, they'd write little parts and write really how you were. Like, uh-huh. I was a young little girl. And they wrote, as I was Janie Powell's little sister, they wrote the part in. Dorothy Kingsley was a wonderful writer on the lot. And so she wrote a little part for me, and I played Janie Powell's sister. It wasn't even in the original script with Ricardo Montalban. It was just a little musical. And we sang, Abba, 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 said the chimpy to the monk with Carlton Carpenter.
And was that song written for you, or was that an old song?
That's an old song also. It was a big hit again in the 30s by somebody. I don't really remember who did that originally.
Now, Carlton had been with you in the number in...
Boop 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 Doo, I Want to Be Loved by You in the other
Three
film,
Little
Three
Words.
Little Words. And so he did this also, Abba Dabba. They wrote a bigger part for Carlton. He was under contract.
And you were a great match because he was so tall and thin and you were a little
Carlton's what? Number. I think he's 6'5", you know, and skinny and still is, and he's still a darling. We still contact each other all the time. He called me little creature. We used to go out on tour. We went out to vaudeville because in those days they wanted you to really learn. it wasn't just about being under contract. They wanted to develop you into an all-around talent. So they sent us out to the Lowell Circuit Theaters because MGM owned the Lowell Circuit Theaters, and we used to do 5 shows a day. And they had an orchestra on the stage. Phil Silvers was the star one time I played. And he's those kind of people that can't, you know, they jump off if they see they're hot too high. What's that? Vertigo thing.
Yes.
Vertigo. So he had a rope and he tied himself around the waist, around the piano leg, in case he would fall in the pit. Because he was frightened of heights.
Wow.
I just love that, though. Had his little clarinet, and he's all tied around the rope to the piano leg. And then the Weir brothers that were great. The Weir brothers were fantastic, like the Ritz brothers. And all these fabulous Adagio acts and Bird acts. And
so now were you kind of starting to feel you belonged to all of this? That you found your natural habitat?
I liked that.
Yeah?
Well, I liked the live. I really liked that a lot. Still do like that the best.
Live audiences and all that?
Yeah, you know, real live people. They know that energy and that love you get from them, and it's just a wonderful vibe. You know, they're just so live people, get you very happy, get you very excited, and I don't know, your energy kicks into a great big gear and you just have the best time of your life out there. I do. I mean, I think probably some people get a little nervous, like my daughter.
Well, your daughter Carrie says she has stage fright, you have stage love.
She's right.
Yeah.
But you know what? She's changing now, Robert. She's doing a show for, it's a cable show, Oxygen thing. She's doing an interview show, and she's loving it. And the other night, she did a big evening. She emceed my daughter in front of a live, the toughest audience in the world, which would be Spielberg and Lucas and Harrison Ford, all show people, a dinner. Yeah. You know, they don't laugh too easily. It's like doing an Oscar show party. And she emceed the whole show, and she had a great time. She was very funny, they say, and put everybody on. And just, I think she's losing that now. I hope so, because then she can work harder and I can retire.
Mm.
Not that I want to.
Now, how did you feel when you first saw yourself up on the screen? I mean, you were such a natural, and the
camera
loved you.
Well, because after singing in the, you know, after we did the Abba Dabba, then, damn, they put me right into Singing in the Rain. Well, I mean, let's ask for a fabulous opportunity. And I couldn't even dance, you know, I'd never danced. So imagine now I was starring with Gene Kelly and Donald O'Connor and Singing in the Rain.
Now there's so many stories about that. Gene Kelly having said that he was really stuck with you, he didn't want you in the picture.
Mm-hmm.
He felt very insulted that they had to take you in the picture. Stanley Donen says, no, that's not true at all. He said, we adored her, we wanted her from the beginning.
Really?
He said there was nobody else on the lot except maybe June Allison, and she was too big a star to do that part. And he said, we were delighted when we could get her. So,
Remember Stanley's name.
What is your interpretation, though, or your memory of that?
I remember Mr. Mayer, I was in his office, and he had an elevated desk, you know, so everyone was a little lower than he was, and he was the king up there, and he was Papa, actually. He was very nice to me, so I have only good memories. And he had me, and he told me that I was going to work with Mr. Gene Kelly, and I said, that's wonderful. And I said, but how am I going to do that, because I don't really dance. He says, you'll dance. You'll dance. That's what he said. And in came Gene Kelly, and Mr. Mayer said, this is your leading lady. This is Debbie Reynolds, and she's going to do the movie, Singing in the Rain. And Gene Kelly looks at me, and he says, do you dance? And I said, no, sir, you don't dance. And he looks at Mr. Mayer, he says, she doesn't dance, Mr. Mayer. He says, she'll dance. And I danced, and I rehearsed 6 months before anybody else. You know, actually, I think it was 3 or 4. But as I get older, it becomes longer. It's like I'm walking through the snow barefoot. But it was the 3 or 4 months by myself with the teachers, you know, before. But no, I think he was stuck with me. I mean, he was told. But I will believe Stanley's story.
Well, you have said also that the two hardest things you ever did in your life was childbirth and Singing in the Rain.
That's right.
Yeah, was he tough on you? Because he was known as a pretty tough guy, even with trained dancers.
Well, I don't think the word is really tough. I think it's exacting, highly disciplined, and demanding to himself more, really, than anybody else. So you had to keep up with Gene. You had to really work, and it was his way, which, well, why not? He was only the greatest, so it should be his way. And you had to work harder than anyone can think of working, and nobody dies from overwork anyway, and especially when you are achieving something great. Look at Singing in the Rain. That's Gene's achievement. American in Paris, a He was a great talent. He was tough. You know, he had a microphone. In those days, you were pre-recorded. So you're up there dancing, and Gene could yell at you. And it wasn't talking, you know, it was yelling at Debbie, more energy, smile, you know. So he could overlap the song and the music. The music would be playing, but they just take his voice out. So he would always be hollering at me to give it more, that's all. So he taught me a great deal. I give it all I have to give. Every time I perform now, I kind of hear his voice in the back. Smile, Debbie, give it more, you know. He was a great teacher.
Well, you're a great dancer in that movie. It's amazing to think you wouldn't, you know, that you weren't trained as a dancer before that.
I know. I'm very proud of that. When I see it, I'm shocked still that I did that, that a little girl did that, that had no training. That's like impossible. When I first went to the premiere, I was very excited and nervous, and I loved it. You know, I got so caught up in it, I forgot it was me. I thought, yeah, I'm doing a really good job. And when we did good morning, and over the couch and all that, that was really tough. Donald Connor's brilliant, of course. We worked really hard on that number. It was the hardest number for me. And that was when my feet were bleeding. The hours were, in those days, we worked Saturdays also, and there were no hours, you know, just as long as they wanted to shoot, they shot. So you just fall apart, just fall on the floor, I would just go to my room, fall on the floor. I never went home, practically. I slept in the dressing room at the studio. I had a little room and a pillow and a blanket. I just stayed there. It was too hard.
When you were so exhausted and tired, there's a wonderful story about you one day when you were, I think, in the rehearsal hall. You just laid down under a piano just to relax. And what happened? You saw a pair of legs.
I was under the piano. It was lunchtime, and I was crying because I couldn't get the steps right because you had to learn them exactly. And Gene had come in and told me that it wasn't good enough. And so all my teachers, everybody went out to eat, and I just went under a grand piano because nobody could see me, and I could sort of go sob to myself. So blubbering under the piano, and a pair of legs walked by, somebody said, "Who's under there? Who's under there? What's the matter?" So I said, "It's just me. I can't learn these dances enough." So he said, "Come out of there now. Just give me your hand." So it was Fred Astaire. He pulls me out from under the piano, and I said, "Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Astaire." He said, "Now why are you crying, Debbie?" I said, "I just can't get these dances. It's so hard. I'll never get it. Oh, yes, you will." Now, Mr. Astaire had guards at the door. He never had people watch him. He had it was off bounds for everybody. While he was creating with Hermes Band, and he just had a drummer with a cane, you know, that's how he created. He says, "All right, now I'm going to take you in, and you're going to watch me rehearse, and you're going to see that this is very hard, no matter how many years you do it, no matter how great you are. This is how it has to be done. It's just blood and sweat. That's the way it is, Debbie, and you have to do it. There's no other way." Now he took me by my head, and he led me into his rehearsal hall. He said, "Sit right there," and I sat right by the door, and watched that man just work for over an hour, just sweating, threw the cane, got upset, turned red, and I finally knew it was time for me to hustle out of there because he was really getting upset about another step. He couldn't find the way, you know. And so I tiptoed out, and I realized that, of course, what he said is right. There is no easy way to try to be great, to try to do it as best you can, better than you can. You just have to sweat it out. You have to just keep drilling. That's what dancing is. And that's why people appreciate it so much and enjoy it, why the audience gets so excited when they see really brilliant dances and steps that they execute that are like impossible, double and triple flips.
And it looks so easy.
It looks so
easy.
That's
the magic, isn't
it? Buster Keaton was there during that time too, you know, and he used to teach me how to do pratfalls. I can do great pratfalls because of Buster Keaton, who would just fall flat on his face if he thought he'd get a laugh, and I still do that.
Going back to that about a college, what a great college to have all those teachers.
Yeah, imagine.
Like Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly and Buster Keaton and others.
And I wanted to go to college, but look at the college I got to go to.
Yeah, exactly. Probably were too busy doing your dances and all that to even have any concept about whether this movie would have a lifespan or not. Did you have any feeling at all that you were creating something unusually good?
I didn't, because I wasn't experienced enough to know that. But Adolph Compton, Betty Green did, you know, Roger Edens did all Special Material, Moses, supposes, mm-hmm. his toes is, I mean, how great can anybody be? And he wrote, Dear Mr. Gable. He did all the Special Material, Roger Edens. And people don't mention his name as much as they should. And I think Stanley and Gene knew, and they felt it. And everybody was terribly excited, Andre Previn. And but I was just working hard to keep up. Mm-hmm. Years later, I thought it was a great movie. And actually, I think, Robert, how this came about again, that this resurgence of the popularity of Singing in the Rain was through colleges and teachers teaching dramatic and the history of film, which, thank God for Mr. Turner, who preserved and shows the old films, and AMC and all these wonderful people that care about preservation. And so we all felt, as this picture resurfaced, that it was through a student movement almost. They said, this is a really funny movie. And it lasted because it's timeless. The story's so much fun, and it's a
the
timeless.
Era, too. Yeah, yeah. It's not modern, so you don't have, it no. doesn't look old-fashioned at all.
No, and the costumes were great. You know, Walter Plunkett was only brilliant. It was a sensational movie, Singing in the Rain.
Now, did it do a lot for your career immediately?
Everything.
Did it?
Well, that was it. After that, they starred me in every picture. After that, there was no more Little Debbie Reynolds. I had to be the leading lady then. I was only 18, so I don't think that I was a leading lady for quite a while. And I did study hard, and I did a good job in the early films. But I certainly, looking back, know I could do better. But
they just put you in one movie after another after that, though.
Yes, we did Tony Randall's first movie, The Mating Game, and I did two Glenn Ford's, Gazebo, and I started with A Kiss. And then I was on loan out for Susan Slept here, Howard Hughes, and that was with Dick Powell, June Allison's husband. June used to come on the set with her kids. And, you know, it was like a university. I always give Esther Williams credit for this one because she always said, it was like a university going to school. We were all the students, and there wasn't any jealousy, you know. Everybody liked, honestly, each other, and nobody was upset if somebody else got the part. Actually, they were thrilled for you.
So you felt very much of a family atmosphere
it
there
was.
At MGM.
Totally. And the writers, there was a Thalberg building. One floor was writers, one floor was directors. And that all ended, of course, the sad part in really as television came in. And like that was 48 and 49 and 50, it started to grow. And Mr. Mayer wouldn't let any of us go on the little black box. He called it that little black box. It'll never last. Should have gone on that word, right? Bought all the stock at that time.
Yeah, exactly.
But he didn't like that little black box. And then, of course, he was thrown out, and all of the what I call family, you know, the producers and the directors, everyone was fired, everyone was let go. Gene Kelly went to, I don't know if it was London or Europe anyway, and they called that runaway production. That was the first, and Burt Lancaster. And people started moving out of Hollywood. And that was the big scare then. And then the Congress, the government, put in that monopoly situation.
Where you couldn't own theaters and make movies for theaters.
Couldn't distribute. Yeah. And own the theater.
Right.
Now what's happening today when you have video
exactly.
and everybody owns everything and everybody, you know, it's interesting that it's come around robin, and yet they haven't really fixed what they put into law for us. None of we older stars get any residuals or anything from any of the work we did, whereas the young people today, God bless them, and they don't know how lucky they are, that they get residuals for their work. A lot of money they get for this, and we receive nothing from any of our work, which I think is a major error. Mickey Rooney went to Washington to try to rectify that and change that, but he didn't get anywhere with it. So it's a shame, but we are grateful that at least the films are saved, and that because of Turner, etc., they are run for a whole other generation. And so, in a way, he's keeping us all around.
Debbie, we're going to show you a scene from Singing in the Rain, and just give us a few comments about it, if you would.
Right. Well, it's not real rain, I'll tell you that. Oh, weren't we cute? And this is the easy part.
But you really lay down the leather in this number.
Donald O'Connor is so cute. So, good morning. See, it was a great set. Did you notice how that camera stays on the outside and you see the edges of the set? I fell off the stool about four times. Gene Kelly said, "What are you, a klutz? You can't stand on a stool?" Now we've got to dance. You'll notice I always look at Gene. I'm terrified. See? That was hard to do, to jump up on that little bench there, because it was kind of tall. Now here we go. Watch this jump down. That looks easy, but it wasn't. These are all Gene's style steps, and you had to do them exactly in unison. See, right together. That's why we rehearse so much. And if you watch closely, we go up the steps, but we never look down when we come down. Watch. Now, how did we do that? I was holding on to Donald. See me looking at Gene? I don't want to make a mistake.
That's a great dance number. Now, when you work very hard on a number, I know that you did You Are My Lucky Star. You did a big number for Singing in the Rain that was cut out of the film. How does that feel when you work so hard on a number and it's gone?
Well, I wasn't in charge, and I never questioned anybody. You know, Robert, my family were very Victorian. I was raised the man, the daddy does, the men are in charge. I never really questioned authority. To this day, as stubborn as I am, as Aries as I am, bossy old me, I still take direction very well. And I feel that daddy's in charge, and whoever's in charge, who signs my check is the boss. I'm not the boss. I'm supposed to work very hard and do the best job creatively and bring a lot to it that I can do. But there is a boss. And if I'm the boss, then I'll go ahead and work myself to death in that area also. And I have been the boss. I've done a lot of productions, and I enjoy that. But I like performing. I like creative people around me. I like the sharing. I like the teamwork. It's so exciting.
You like the work process.
I like the work process, the word process. I like everybody contributing, because you get so much more there on the plate if you have talented people around you and not afraid of you, but work with you.
Now, how do you feel about the publicity end of the business? Because about this time, after Singing in the Rain and everything, you were showing up on magazine covers, you know, 3 and 4 a month. How did that feel, that aspect of it?
Well, we used to be on like 300 covers a year. Elizabeth and Debbie and Doris Day and June Allison and Janet Lee and all the girls under contract, you know, Lana Turner, Ava Gardner. Look how many people were under contract. Greer Garson, Norma Shearer. Now, forget that the men were all the greats. Spencer Tracy, Mickey Rooney, Fran Astaire, Jean Kay. Ah, it was just such a wonderful roster of talented people. And yes, we were all, and Gary Cooper. When you met everybody else, too, you went to every other studio. You went to Fox. Bob Wagner, Tab Hunter, Rock Hudson was a Universal, Tony Curtis. And so we all partied together. When I say partied, they had premieres, lots of premieres in those days, lots of parties. And we loved it. We'd all go to all the parties. We were also told to go, and the studio would line us up with each other for a date. That's how I was Tab Hunter's date. I was RJ, Bob Wagner's date. They lined us up, a boy called Craig Hill's date. I didn't even know them. I mean, I would be driven and to meet them in a parking lot, and then we'd all get in the car and go to the party together. And that's how we all...
For a photo op, right?
For a photo op. And it would be like an opening of a restaurant. And so that was Photoplay, Modern Screen, all those kind of... But they were very clean magazines when I say that. There was no gossip, meaning, oh, who's sleeping with who and who, what, you know. Nowadays, it's such a rag, rags, you know. Not that we don't all enjoy reading about all of the gossip, because I think people enjoy that.
What about your clothes? Did you have to supply your own clothes for those photo op opportunities?
Yes, I didn't have many clothes, but my mother made my clothes. Mama went to night school. She always sewed, but she didn't know how to make really things fancy. But Helen Rose would do a sketch and give it to me.
MGM designer.
MGM designer, great designer, Helen Rose, who did Grace Kelly's wedding gown, and all the girls, Lana Turner, she loved all the girls. she also thought we were like her kids, you know. Walter Plunkett would do designs for us too, Edith Head. And I'd give them to Mother. And the neighbor lady, I had a good, sweet neighbor lady, Mrs. Croft, and she would help Mama cut a pattern, and they would make me a beautiful dress. I went to a party with Hugh O'Brien to Marion Davies' house and was so excited because it was in Beverly Hills. And, you know, she was rich, and, you know, married to who? Mr. William Randolph Hearst.
Not married, but
you know, dabbling.
Yes.
And this was a Beverly Hills big mansion with Spanish, everything. She had in each room different cuisine. You know, she had this food and that food and this, and music to go with each one. And I wanted to go, and Hugh had invited me, and I didn't have any clothes. Anything to wear. I certainly didn't have enough money to buy something really gorgeous. So Mother and my neighbor made me a beautiful white lace skirt and a black velvet top I won't ever forget. Then I didn't have a jacket. Janie Powell loaned me her little mink, like a little capelet. And Lillian, my drama coach, loaned me her evening bag and a ring. She let me wear her emerald ring. Oh, I was just Miss Fancy. And I had the best time of anybody at the party, of course. And in the pool, all orchids were floating. Oh, this was Hollywood.
Hollywood in the old days,
this
yes.
This was Hollywood, yeah.
Now, do you remember how much you were making about this time? I mean, you're already a star.
That was $300 a week days. But I kept it all because I wanted to go back to school, not realizing the great school that I was now going to go on and stay in, which I was under contract to MGM, I think it was 14, 15 years.
With a lot of loan outs in there thrown in as well.
Yeah, three or four loan outs that I was able to do. And then I did, I guess these were loan outs too, The Pleasure of His Company. And
Tammy
my
at Universal.
Tammy, that's right, Tammy.
Which was a big success for you.
It was, with Leslie Nielsen.
Uh-huh.
That was his first comedy picture, and he hated it. He didn't like it at all because he didn't like comedy. Leslie liked drama only. And now look at him.
Exactly.
Doing all these, whatever their names are, Naked Gun, Naked Edge, whatever
right,
they are.
Right.
And he's making zillions, and he loves it. He loves the comedic side of himself that he's now found.
Now, at this time, you were working very hard, and you were going out a lot to these parties. Did you ever fall in love around this time?
Well, I was
ever
working.
Ever had crushes on anybody?
Oh, no. Oh, crushes. Well, I always had a crush on Robert Wagner. He was just, I thought, the most handsome and stunning young man of all the boys. So he was my first crush, but all the other girls thought he was the same too. You know, he dated a lot of girls. I certainly wasn't it wasn't a steady situation, but we dated a lot. He was really sweet to me. So I would say he was my first crush. When I was making a picture called Hit the Deck, kind of a corny little movie with Janie Powell and Victor Moan and Tony Martin, Ann Miller, and they brought Eddie Fisher on the set, who was a recording artist. He had like 20 gold albums, you know, I mean gold, those things, records.
Right, records.
So, Oh My Papa and Lady of Spain and all that. And I think they were considering him Mr. Pasternak, Joe Pasternak, for a contract. I'm not sure if that was it or if they were just showing him around the lot because he was a big star then. And then I met him and he called me for a date and went out with him two nights. And on the third date, he proposed to me. And I said yes. I thought that was really a bad decision, but.
Did you think so at the time? No.
Naturally not. He's darling, he was darling, he was so cute, and we just were young, and I was 21.
Now, around this time, you were also making The Tender Trap with Frank Sinatra, right?
Yes, I was doing The Tender Trap with Frank Sinatra.
And did he give you some advice about getting married?
Yes.
To a singer?
He took me to lunch one day, he said, and that was unusual. He called me Sweetie. Okay, Sweetie, let's go. And I called him Sweetie. I don't know why. I was just kidding around. He was so much fun. I loved him. And he said, let's go, and we're going to go have lunch. So he had never said that to me before. So I said, yes, sir. So we were in the commissary. He said, now, I have to talk to you seriously about this, Debbie, because I read in the paper, or somebody told me, that you're considering, you're engaged to Eddie. Fisher. I said, yes, sir. Well, he's a singer. Yes, sir. Shouldn't marry a singer. I said, well, why not? It's an unsteady situation. He said, singers have a lot of people around them. Life is not quite steady. He said, we should reconsider. I think he's too young. You should date. Just date. Don't get married. And never to a singer. And see, I didn't listen to his advice either. Well, that was sweet of him, don't you
think
so?
Yes, it was.
And he really meant it.
Did you like him?
I loved Frank. I thought he was, I'm sure if you were on his bad side, that wouldn't be good. But I was never on his bad side, and I was so thrilled to be working with Frank Sinatra. You can name anybody else. I think that I was more excited about working with Frank Sinatra. And Jimmy Stewart was also another one. Yeah, oh, well, I loved them all, really. I loved Glenn Ford. I always wanted to make a movie with Jack Lemmon. But Frank was, to me, the most giving, you know. He really was the sweetest guy, unlike a lot of rumors and stories. And like I say, maybe if you got on his wrong side, who's not to say that he would definite and tough with you. I don't know. I never wanted to be on his bad side, so we had a lot of fun together. He just treated me like a little kid. I mean, all the way through, for years and years and years later, just prior to his passing, the last time he was performing in Vegas, I always went to see him every time. And I take all the kids that work for me. I say, you have to go see Sinatra. That is legendary. And you must see everybody legendary if you say you're in show business. It's important that you go to catch every act and watch how they work, especially Frank Sinatra. So we went to see him, and I took all my kids, and I had about 7 in the show then. And they were thrilled, of course, to hear Sinatra. And he had me sit at his table with his family. And afterwards, he leaned down and said, you join me, sweetie. So we had dinner with all his friends, too. I mean, Don Rickles was there, and Stephen Eady and all that. So he said, you sit right here. Sit right here. Debbie, right here. So it's for some reason, he was very fond of me, as almost like his little kid, like his own little girl. You know, he bossed me around. I loved it.
On the level of the people you were working with, like Frank Sinatra and Glenn Ford and Jimmy Stewart, et cetera, did you find many that you didn't like or that weren't good people?
No, some of the directors I had a hard, like Richard Brooks was a really, really tough director.
And the Catered Affair.
The Catered Affair with Betty Davis, Ernie Borgnine, Barry Fitzgerald, whom I loved, all of them. But he had a thing about Hollywood actresses. He didn't like that I was engaged to Eddie at that time. He just called me the little Hollywood something. He had a name for me. I can't remember what it was. He didn't care about, didn't like me at all. Didn't want me in the movie. He was furious he had to take me in the movie. And I thought I did a good job.
You're wonderful in that.
Really wonderful in that. I thought I was.
You should have had an Academy Award nomination for that.
Robert.
Yeah, that was a great performance.
Oh, that's sweet of you.
It really is.
And he hated me, and he picked on me. Oh, I was in tears all the time. Betty Davis took me in her room, and you just can't pay attention to him. The crew didn't like him at all. They ran the camera over his feet. That was a happy day.
That's a good way to get a director.
I like that. And he just had a little spur, you know. Everyone says that about Richard. He's a great director, great writer. So I can't complain. I didn't know him personally. Perhaps in real life, perhaps at home, he was sweet. I don't know that. You'd have to ask Gene Simmons.
That must be very difficult to work under those conditions, though.
It was very hard for me, and I was very tearful through the whole. Rod Taylor was darling, and he starred with me in that. I was a star. I mean, Betty Davis. But they were so good. Ernie Borgnine worked with me and say, now, Debbie, don't be upset. Just play the scene naturally. This is Chekhov. You just have to speak the lines. Be for real. Be real. Don't let him get to you. You know, just be real. Because I was very upset naturally. And, well, we lived through it somehow. But he was the only one that was ever really mean to me. Hathaway was difficult on How the West Was Won, but he wanted me in that movie.
Henry Hathaway,
How the West Was Won. And he's a great director, many tons of pictures, and very powerful director. And the rumor was from Susan Hayward and Glenn Ford and everybody, he's the toughest director in the whole world, and he'll cuss you out all the time, and he's mean as can be, makes you use like real spiders and not fake spiders. One of those, I said, well, I don't want to work with anybody like that. So he came over to Fox to see me, and he said, well, you're going to do this picture with me, aren't you, Debbie? I said, you know, sir, I have to tell you the truth. Honestly, I don't want to work in an unhappy situation, and I can't handle it if people yell at me. I just can't handle it. I don't want to be unhappy, and the picture won't be any good if we're going to have any problems like that. So, what the hell are you talking about? And he started cussing at me. I'm never a mean one. And he started saying all these words. Right away, he starts, bam, you know. So I said, well, so I agreed to do the movie if he would never cuss at me or yell at me and always treat me nicely. That's all. You know, I wasn't asking any favors. The first day I arrived on the set, and we were in Paducah, Kentucky. We were supposed to look out on over this river, and Jimmy Stewart, supposedly a trapper, coming down, but he doesn't tell me that. He says, we were rushing, and the weather was bad, and he said, now just go up there and look out at the river. I said, what am I looking at? He says, what the hell do you care what you're looking at? You just look out the river and just get up there. He starts yelling at me. So I said, I told you I wouldn't do that. I have to know what I'm looking at. Well, you're not going to know what you're looking at, and he starts in on me. So I had told him if he ever did that, I'd just faint. So I fainted for the day. I wouldn't wake up. It was hard because you kept putting Epsom salts, what's that stuff, under your nose, you know?
Smelling salts, yes.
I just had my eyes closed. And he stared down at me, cussed me. I said, you little soul, you get up, you're just faking it. And I wouldn't get up. And then to the crew, I just opened one eye, you know, just one eye. So they all knew I was faking it. That's the last time he cussed at me. He was a wonderful man. I loved him, but he did have that way.
That was a huge project, How the West Was Won.
One whole year.
Yeah.
One full year. Tough locations, you know, too. Colorado, snow. They had to break away the ice in the water, and then you got in. Oh.
And you're working with the Cinerama cameras, three cameras,
very
right?
Very hard that was, Cinerama, because it's this way. You know, you can't get near the camera. You have to stand way over here, so you can't look at the actor. You have to look in the camera at an actor, but the actor's here, so you just hear his voice or her voice. Very, very hard. It was a difficult experience, but great, because I got to work with Jimmy Stewart, John Wayne, the world was
Gregory
in that
Peck.
Movie. Gregory Peck and Agnes Moorehead.
That was your first picture with Agnes Moorehead, right?
That was my
first
film.
Who was a great friend of yours?
She became my best friend. I just thought she was an extraordinary woman and the dearest and greatest actress of all time. Had she lived in London, she would be dame, lady, whatever that they honor you with in England. Whereas she should have been more honored, our Agnes, because she was such a fine dramatic actress.
What was she as a person? We only kind of see the brittle kind of lady she used to play in films and everything.
Well, I think that those are her features.
Uh-huh.
Don't you? I mean, her nose was... She was such a character actress,
mm-hmm.
So she had that rather, you know, sat like that, and she was always so proper. But the real Agnes was the sweetest woman ever, and she had all her students, and if you had no money, she'd let them stay at her house, and she was mother to all. She was a great lady. And I'd like to say publicly, there's a rumor about Agnes being gay, and I don't mind whoever is, but Agnes was simply a terribly religious woman and didn't mess around, you know, so her life was very pious, you know, very singular. But I don't like rumors that aren't the truth about someone, and she's not here to defend herself, but I am.
You also worked with Thelma Ritter. On that movie.
Thelma Ritter is one of the funniest women ever living. And we were best of friends, like with Alice Pierce, who was the funniest woman that ever lived. And they used to come to my house all the time with George Gobel, because Eddie Fisher did the show with George Gobel. And we just told jokes all night long. Laugh. There was nobody funnier than Thelma. She was married to a guy, lived in New York, loved plays. Joe Moran. I loved her. I'll miss her.
Now, you're married to Eddie Fisher,
mm-hmm.
and you did Tammy. You had a big hit record. How did that sit with your husband, that all of a sudden somebody who wasn't basically a singer had a big hit record?
Oh, I don't know. I don't think it bothered him. I think it didn't bother him. He had 20 gold records, so we were happily married at that time.
And you did a film together around that time, right?
Oh, that was awful. Bundle of Joy. Oh, Bundle of Nothing. Some people liked it. I just thought it was terrible.
It's a remake of an old Ginger Rogers movie, right?
Oh, no, and David Niven. It was a great old movie. And we did it, but it was, I don't think that's a good movie.
And how was that working with Eddie? Because he wasn't experienced as an actor. You were as an actress at that point.
I think it's very hard working with your husband, I think. And especially if they're new at it, because if anything goes wrong, they rather blame you. So there was tension on the set. That was hard. And I was expecting Carrie at the time. So I was nauseous and, you know, that was a hard shoot. I don't remember that fondly. Not a good time.
Well, how was he to work with since he, did you help him? Did you have to help him?
Oh, because he didn't allow anyone to help him, no. That's another problem. Well, I'm his wife, so what do I know, you know? So that was a little difficult. I would say it's not one of my pleasant memories. In fact, I haven't even thought about it, and I'm not going to think about it again.
Good old me for bringing it
Thank
up, right?
Thank you so much, Robert.
Now, when your career is going like gangbusters at this point, like gangbusters, mm-hmm. the marriage isn't going so great.
That happened all at once. My career was going very well, yes. But when Eddie left, then all that ridiculous publicity and all, the studio jumped on that bandwagon sort of and worked me even harder.
I know you've told this story 100 times and would ask about it, but just do a brief recap.
The fact that Mike Todd was a producer, 80 Days Around the World and so forth. I don't know, people out there might not know Mike Todd, but he was a very fine producer, entrepreneur guy, and, you know, great guy. And we ran around together. And
he was Eddie's best friend.
He was Eddie Fisher's best friend, and then he started dating Elizabeth, even though she was married to Michael Wilding, because that was a breakup time then for them. And she just fell madly in love with Mike Todd, who was really a charismatic guy who dated Marlena Dietrich. You know, all the women were crazy about
Gypsy
him.
Gypsy Rose Lee.
Anne Southern. Yeah. You know. Oh, the women loved him. And he loved them. And then when he met Elizabeth, though, he just flipped for Elizabeth, and she with him. An untimely death happened, and Elizabeth had just had her baby, a little girl.
He was killed in an airplane.
He was killed in a plane crash accident. Going to, I think it was the Friars roast in New York for somebody. And it was just a sad, sad, awful thing. So I heard it in the morning. I was listening to the news. In those days, I used to go to bed early because of the children. Nowadays, I'm nocturnal. But then I was up early, and I remember it was like 6, 7 in the morning, and I heard the news about Mike's plane crash and no survivors. So I quickly awakened Eddie, and I said, you have to go right away. So we both went to Elizabeth's house, and the doctors had just gotten there, and they just told her, and she was screaming, and it was just awful. And so I said to Eddie, you should stay because I'll take the children and take them home, because now the press is swarming all over her house. And it was a rental house, and it was right on the street, and it wasn't protected. So I left with the nurse and the three children. I might have been two nurses at that time, and I took them home to my house, which wasn't far away. And Michael Wilding flew in that day, and he stayed with me, too. I had everybody in my house. And my husband was with Elizabeth, and stayed with Elizabeth. At that time, that wasn't to be expected, but he was great comfort to her, and I was happy for that. And then she had to go to New York, and then he said he had to go for work. But he really went to be with Elizabeth, which I found out. And realized that there was something going on seriously there. And of course, that's very hard. And I was 24, I think, you know, and I had two children. And
it was also public as well.
It was very public, red ink. 100 reporters in your front yard and all over. You couldn't get out of your house, and my children were little, and so that was a very difficult time. And anyone in any public life knows that when they're all over you, you know, the press can be very without a heart. You know, they just want that story, and they don't really care how they get it. And I was very good because I would go out and hand write, you know, statements and things, trying to keep everybody happy. But they really jumped on the bandwagon. All the press were very cruel, and it was hard. And that went on because I wasn't going to give a divorce, because I'm Nazarene, and I really didn't believe in divorce. I believed that if you wanted to go. But I wasn't going to do a sin. And I was raised very strict Nazarene, and I just thought it would be a sin to get a divorce, you know, just not the thing to do. And I thought it would be a fling, and that he would probably go off for a couple of years and come back. And of course, that's exactly, it ended with Elizabeth in 2 years, but he didn't come back to me. But I didn't want him by then back, because life goes on and you do change yourself, and you don't really forgive being hurt that much. So that whole thing ended. He went off with Elizabeth, and then they were very happy together until she met Richard Burton. Yeah, they were doing Cleopatra. I only know this story because I met them much later. I met Richard and Elizabeth after they were together, and she had sent Mr. Fisher packing. So I guess what goes up, life comes down, you know.
Were you and Elizabeth Taylor friends before all this Eddie debacle?
What a way to put it. We went to a school together on the lot at Metro. They had a little schoolhouse, and Mrs. McDonald, I think it was, and she and I were the only students, Elizabeth and I. And so she was constantly working, Elizabeth, as a leading lady. She hated school. Oh, I loved school because I still, in my back of my mind, somehow I wanted to go back and become the gym teacher. And I was now 17, and I hadn't made Singing in the Rain yet. So that's when I first met Elizabeth. And we were the same age. So we were in the schoolhouse together. Janie Powell had already gone on, and Roddy McDowell was sometimes in class, younger, but he was in the class. So I think we were all the same age. I keep forgetting, Debbie, about Roddy. What a great guy. Mm-hmm. Sure miss Roddy. And so we just knew each other as girlfriends-like. And then when I married Eddie, and because Elizabeth was with Mike Todd, we became closer then because we ran around together. Pardon me. And when she married Mike, I was her matron of honor. Down in Acapulco, I washed her hair, I set her hair, and got her all dressed for her wedding. Little did I know what the future was going to be. And I really liked Elizabeth, you know. And I liked being with the four of us, had a lot of fun together at that time. So what came about comes about in life, and now it's long in the past, but that's sort of how all that started. But I like Elizabeth. She's changed a lot, and she works very hard now for AIDS, and she has a different attitude. After all, she has survived death 6 or 7 times. So God wanted her to stay, perhaps just to do this wonderful work.
Now, all this scandal that went on, did that have any kind of a negative effect on your career, or a positive effect, or any effect at all?
Well, I think it jump-started, or whatever you call that, my career, as far as being a leading lady. They just put me in picture after picture after picture. So negative would be what it did to me as far as my career, probably helped my career, but I wasn't really caring about that at that time. It was just a big difficult situation, but we've all lived through it and life goes on.
It's amazing the number of times though that life has kind of knocked you down and you've gotten right back up again and fought through it again. Where did that come from? That
I'm
survival
sure
instinct.
I think everybody in the world gets knocked down a few times. I've just had a few more blows, perhaps, than some other people.
And yours are more public than most people's.
That's true, but that's because of the industry, and that's the way those things go. I always find if you get knocked down, you can always get back up. You might struggle, you might stagger, you might even fall down again. But if you keep going and struggling through it, you can get through it. It just takes a long time to recover from a tremendous unhappiness. But I always thought of it as a 5-year plan. You know, not today and not tomorrow, not in a year, but there's a tunnel and there's a light at the end of the tunnel, and I can get to that light. It just takes time. You have to be very patient to survive life. It's going to hit you hard, but you can do it. You can make it.
That brings up The Unsinkable Molly Brown, one of your great, maybe your best movie so far. I mean, it's a part that was perfect for you, although you weren't the first choice for it. As I understand, Shirley MacLaine was set to do it and couldn't get out of a contract with Hal Wallace to do it. That's amazing to me, again, how the industry works, because you'd been, a year before in How the West Was Won, one of MGM's biggest successes.
Right.
You'd always been a success for MGM. You had to fight for that part that was so right for you.
Well, Chuck Walters, the director, wanted Shirley MacLaine, and she wanted it, and they didn't know there'd be a stumbling block with Hal Wallace and an old contract. And I was under contract to MGM, and I wanted to do it like crazy. I went to see Mr. Walters, Chuck Walters. We became good friends anyway after that, but he didn't want me. He just did not want me. And so when Shirley had this really big problem and just couldn't get out of the contract, and the movie wouldn't have been made because she had this condition with Mr. Wallace, so Chuck Walters came to my house one day, and he said, we had a long talk. I mean, it was raining that day, and it was an interesting day, and he said, Debbie, I absolutely don't want you in this part. I don't think you can do it. You're just not good enough, and you're too short for the part. And I said, how short is the part? It's an old Helen Hayes line. When they didn't want her to play Queen Victoria, she said, how short is the part? And she did the play and won a Tony and Sarah Siddons Award and everything else. So he changed his mind after about 8 weeks of shooting, took that long. I never worked so hard on any film as I did that film, other than perhaps Mother and, you know, of recent work. But it was just, he just sort of had a prejudice about it. But I think mostly it was that he was just such a big fan of Shirley MacLaine's. He did Some Came Running with Shirley, and that's all that was. And he got over it, and I think it was my best performance and certainly my best role, other than Singing in the Rain. But I was a young little girl, and it wasn't a demanding part. Molly Brown was a very demanding role, and I was honored to be nominated for that for an Academy Award.
You later did it on stage, as I understand.
I wanted to do it on stage because I wanted to prove to myself that I could still cut the mustard and do all the dance steps and leap off the bar and leap into the air. And that really was my swan song to Tough Dancing, because when I did it on stage, I forget my age, but I was about 60. And I said, well, I knew this would be the last time I could really cut those dance steps. So I did it for 2 years, and then I was happy to do that. I love that role.
Debbie, we're going to look at a scene now from The Unsinkable Molly Brown for some more comments.
Right.
Great number.
Yeah, Peter Gennaro did this dance number. You know him. He, great New Yorker. He did the original show with Tammy Grimes. This was the hardest number anybody could ever do, if you watch. This is called an Irish jig, supposedly. And we shot this all in one take, two cameras. That's Grover Dale on one side with the red socks. Gus Traconis is on the other side. A wonderful actor. Look at that. It's murder, this dance. See, it hasn't been one cut. This is all in one take. And this part, da-ba-da-ba-ba-da-ba-ba-da-ba-ba-da. It's very hard, this jigging. Can't make a mistake. The three of us, da-da. So unison.
The floor looks slick, too, is it?
No, it wasn't slick. It's just highly glossy, but you can't dance on a slick floor. See, and I'm in heels and a skirt, so don't you think the women have it harder than the guys? Well, watch how these, it's so intricate. Not a stop yet. This is a 7-minute number, not one cut. I had to learn it in 2 days, too. The boys had 16 weeks. See, Gene Kelly taught me pretty good. Go, girl. Kick. Here comes the hard part now, Robert. Watch this one. Here we go. Get over. Watch. I barely make it. Oh! Did you see me push up?
Yeah, but you did great. Now, right around this time, Hollywood is changing terribly. The studios were kind of going out of business. You made a lot of people happy by buying a lot of things at the MGM auction that they had and storing them away at a time when not a lot of people had a lot of interest in what was happening to Hollywood artifacts and everything like that. Tell us about that.
Rona Barrett said that Debbie Reynolds was at the auction buying a bunch of junk. Most people didn't, a lot of people don't care about preservation and they just think it's a lot of junk. Well, I think it's history. And I think it's we should save. This is the greatest industry, and American films have influenced the world in fashion, in styles, and the anything about Bonnie and Clyde, you know, especially the films, The Godfather. I mean, the world loves American films. Why shouldn't we save our history? Well, we are trying now to save preservation of the films and preserving them, restoring them. But what about our costumes and all the sets? That's what I bought at the MGM auction in 1970. I just bought everything I could afford to do. I went to the bank. I borrowed money. I broke my heart. I couldn't stand to see them selling. That was the time everyone should have given, and there should have been a museum built by all the studios, and that it should have been all of them, Warner Brothers and Universal and everybody all together. And that's what it is. It's an industry. It's not an individual industry. It is now, but in those days it wasn't, and that was the time to save everything. Unfortunately, no one did it. I have the largest private collection in the world, and now we hope to build our new museum in Hollywood. I was in Las Vegas, and I lost that, and that was very sad, but I didn't lose any of the memorabilia. So we have fabulous things, of course, the Marilyn Monroe subway dress, all these precious things from silent screen era up until like the middle 70s. So I'm praying for it to work, and we're now still in negotiations on money because these are not easy times for the whole world, and so bankers get a little frightened. I don't know why, because this is for the world to see. Fans love to see their favorite stars and their memories and their youth and the time when they went to that movie at that time. It might have been they became engaged. It might have been a special time in their lives, you know, that they had their children. So all of this should be preserved. And I would like that to be my contribution back to show business that's given me such a great life, if I can get it done. I don't know that I will, but I'm certainly trying to do that.
I went to the exhibit in Las Vegas, which was fabulous. Yeah. And you had so many interesting things. I remember a huge portrait of Greer Garson from Mrs. Parkington that you had. Mm-hmm. A lot of wonderful things like that off the sets that you had from the movies and the way you displayed them so well. Things from Ben-Hur and everything.
Ben-Hur, the Holy Grail, you know, all the Ben-Hur, Cleopatra, all the thrones, and Charles Lawton, all these fabulous costumes from Marie Antoinette and Garbo and Katharine Hepburn, and just every movie. I bought every Academy Award movie. So it's Ingrid Bergman, Gaslight, and all the costumes from Gaslight, Romeo and Juliet, all these fabulous costumes. So it needs to be saved, and it should be. It is saved. It now needs to be shown.
You also had a wonderful idea when they were selling off the back lot of MGM,
yeah.
the third back lot at MGM, mm-hmm. that is now a housing project. But what was your idea then?
Well, I went to Mr. The man was Krikorian that owned it, but Jim Aubrey ran it, and I said, just put a turnstile. I'll go every day, sign autographs, let people buy a ticket, and it'll become like Disneyland. Save it. Don't have condominiums, please. But they were liquidators, and so they liquidated.
And so what do we have now? Universal City.
So Universal, you know how they did it, and that was Mr. Dorskin, and he did it, and Mr. Wasserman. Well, you need a little vision, don't you?
Now, you went back to Broadway, or you went to Broadway. You'd done Broadway at the Capitol Theater with Carlton Carpenter and everything way back, but you went to Broadway starring in Irene, directed by Gower Champion. What was that experience like? Because that's your audience, your live audience.
See, that's right. Well, my husband had just lost everything, and we were dead broke. And so
Harry Carl
was my second husband, a man of millions, and he lost everything gambling. And he lost all my money, his money, everything. So at that time, I'd been working a long time, so I had quite a few million also that he lost, gave away, whatever. It's a sad disease to be a gambleholic. It's a very sad case, and it really hurts the family and the children. I finished raising his children and mine, so that was five. But I had to leave, and I went to Broadway because Harry Rigby had offered me a play a while back called Irene, and I, of course, didn't want to do it. I wanted to stay and raise my children. I didn't know at that time Harry was losing everything. And so I remembered that, and I called Mr. Rigby up in New York, and I said, are you still interested in having me come there? Because I had to save our lives. I had to jump into the ocean and swim because I had to pull it together. You know, I couldn't let the children down. I had to raise the family, and it's very expensive to raise children that are in college and high school. And so I went there, and God was good. Gower Champion came in to save the production because it wasn't good.
Didn't Sir John Gielgud start directing it at the beginning?
Sir John was hired, and Hugh Wheeler was writing.
What an interesting concept to have John Gielgud directing a musical.
Well, he's a wonderful man, brilliant man. He did a lot of operas in England. But this is a comedy, you know, a light-hearted, whimsical musical, and just wasn't working. So the producers was the hardest thing I've ever seen anybody have to do, would be to go to Sir John Gielgud, a man of brilliant talents, and say, we no longer wish you to continue. He cried.
Wow.
And so we were lucky enough to, I called Gower in Los Angeles. We were good friends. He was on the beach with a girlfriend having a good time. And I was in Philadelphia in the rain, and it was so depressing. And Gower came in for me, he did it for me, and saved the show. So for 2 years I was on Broadway in Irene. And it was the hardest thing I think I've done, really, physically. Because it was a great dance play, you know, great triple flips, and I did all that in those days. And It was exhausting. I lived in New York with I brought my son. Carrie was in the chorus. And I stayed in New York 2.5 years, so it's almost 2.5. So I had a good time. It was a good experience for me. And I pulled out of debt. I was able to save, you know, a little bit of money so that I could come back to Los Angeles and rent a house and keep my son Todd in school. So I got through it. That took 10 years because I had to pay off all his debts, which was about $10 million. And that took everything. The bank just took liens on every check I made. And that took a long time. And that was a very hard time, you know. And I didn't have a place to stay, really. But I had my kids in school and taken care of. So I slept in my car. And that was about a year. And
you slept in your car?
I had my clothes in the trunk. And I slept in my car. And I called it. I had an old Chevrolet that a friend had gotten me for $1,000, and all the birds used to poop on it, so I called it my bird turd car. Nobody would park it. I'd go to the Beverly Hills Hotel and they'd wave me on. I'd hold a $5 bill out so they'd park it. They wouldn't just wave me on. They wouldn't park my car because I wouldn't wash it. Because I said, it's like my life. It's just a mess. I'm not going to wash it. It's just, we'll go down together. So these were hard years, yeah. I've had quite a few.
Do you ever get really discouraged, when you're really down in the dumps?
Of course, sure.
And how do you pull out of that? That's something we can all learn. How do you do that?
Well, I'm very religious. I believe that I have someone that cares. There is a way you can survive. You can believe in yourself. You can get back up. You have to work very hard, and you have to stop crying. You have to get out of bed and move along. You have to get out there and try and fail again. If you never step out of the closet, if you never try any new venture, if you never walk down a new path, and if the path that you're on isn't working, change the path. Walk down a new path. You can make it. You just have to think of that 5-year plan, the end of the tunnel. Take your time. Otherwise, you become frightened. If you take it day by day, you can make it through the day. It's better to take it 5 years, then you won't become frightened. You can make it. If you think about it too soon, it's too hard. And yes, it is depressing, but you don't have to go with that. I mean, you do for a few days, weeks, might take you a month. But then you finally have to get out of that bed or out of that corner and walk out there and find a new job. Think of something new. God has been good to me because I have really a wild imagination. And I know I'd be good in advertising. I know I could be somebody's personal assistant. I have great experience in show business. I could make a director a great assistant. I could take another job. You can't be conceited. You have to be happy with yourself and know that whatever you do, you'll be good at it because you care and you want to be good at it. Unhappiness, you have to get over, because if you just fill your well with unhappiness, you can never fill the well with a wonderful life that you can have that is there. You just have to rise above it.
Have you always had a good, strong support team?
Yes. My mother raised me with religion, and my mother and daddy, and I have a fabulous brother, and my kids are great. My son Todd is really like a real strong arm for me, and my daughter Carrie is gifted and wonderful and loves me, and she has a little granddaughter. And everybody loves me, so my family loves me.
So your family is your real strength there.
My family, my religion.
And your religion.
First is religion, and then my family, and then it's my audience, because I'm never without the feeling of being cared for. Because when I walk on the stage, people yell at me, "We love you, Debbie." Oh, my goodness, Robert. You know, to have my husband's, you know, it's my fault. I made poor choices. So I must blame myself for that and walk ahead. And my joy is, as I say, religion and my children, and then my work.
Do you ever anticipate not working?
No, I always say this little joke about it, that I'm going to be like George Burns. I'm going to just be on the stage till I drop dead. Then I'm going to have myself stuffed like Trigger.
Now, talk about Las Vegas, because you owned a hotel there for a while. That was another thing that didn't work out so well, but you gave that a good shot.
Yeah, so my husband helped that come down.
This was another husband.
I'm married three times. Three times you strike, you're out. And my last husband lives in Virginia and had ambition to be a wealthy man on a lot of my money. So that went down, and I blame him a great, great deal, and there's about three others along with him. They just chewed me up, spit me out on the floor.
And did you have this hotel, and where you also had a cabaret where you did shows?
It was,
and you had your museum
there. I think it was 11 acres, mm-hmm. and it was a 194-room little hotel. That I didn't really care about that so much, but I was always vacuuming, taking care of it, and making it look nice. And I had a restaurant. There was a restaurant, and I looked after that. And my Todd designed a beautiful showroom for me, a 500-seater, just beautiful, all, you know, maroon, wine color, burgundies, and crystal, and just fabulous for me. So I had a runway, and, you know, I did my show there for over 7 years. And we did two shows every day. And we were always sold out. And then I built my little museum there with all the artifacts. Not all, I mean, but, you know, a wonderful exhibit with this everything moving, the stages moved, and you saw it, Robert. And it was really wonderful. And Todd is a marvelous designer. So my dream was done. You know, I was really happy. That's where I'd stay and I'd perform. And I had a little nightclub there called Jazz and Jokes. And every Friday, Saturday, I loved it. That's where I was going to stay and be happy. But again, life isn't like that, you know, and a great big storm came up and just wiped it all away again. So again, I was broke again. So that was only, now it's about five years ago that all came tumbling down. And so you just have to, again, start over again. I'm 70 now, so it's harder now, and you have to be more careful now. So I shan't step forward anymore.
You had your great success in Mother. After that,
Albert Brooks put me in the film Mother. I was so lucky, and I thank Albert very much. And it was a lot of work because I hadn't done movies in 27 years. So he wrote a great script, and it was brilliantly written about a mother and a son's relationship. And I thought it was a terrific picture, Mother. I was lucky. Well, Albert was so good to let me do it.
Had the filmmaking process changed a lot in those 27 years?
No, just handheld cameras. That's a whole new thing. It's very wonderful and interesting how that camera just floats in the air. You know, it's just strapped to a man, usually a man's body, and just floats, follows you around the set. Not so many cuts. And it makes it harder, in a way, on the actors because you really have to know tons and tons of dialogue and more pages that you do. You go all the way through. But it's been very interesting. I've done two Disney films since then called Halloween Town that the kids love. So now, like, 4 or 5 and up to 12-year-olds come up and say, "Are you Grandma Aggie?" And I say, "Yes." And I like doing films for children. You know, I'd be really interested in doing even a children's program on television.
And you have a pilot for a new series?
I did. I just finished a pilot for Warner Brothers, or WB, I guess it's called. I think it's cable. I'm not sure what. And it's very funny. It's called Nutty Grandma. Now they've changed the title to Generation Gap. I don't know what the title will be, but perhaps that might work. I don't know.
And you
know,
play the title role?
I play the title role of Nutty Old Grandma. I just keep walking on these paths, and one of them will smooth out, and then I'll go along it.
You're one of the few people that's active in show business today that's had a movie not written about you, but kind of based on your life, Postcards from the Edge, that your daughter wrote.
Well, my daughter wrote that. She wrote a book, and it was about a boy who had a problem, and their mother was just sort of not insignificant much in the book. It was a wonderful book, and then Mike Nichols optioned it and wanted the problem to be about a mother and a daughter, So Carrie wrote that screenplay, and of course I'm her mother, so she copied me, be that I am Auntie Mame and a party girl, I love to go out, love to party, love to talk, you know, love to share stories. My partying is really about visiting. That's what I love. Drinking, I always have my little wine there, a little glass of wine, two glasses of wine. I certainly don't have a problem of alcoholism, thank God, you know, because I like to party, and I'd like it to be pleasure. I don't ever want to be out of control. I'm very funny that way. I like to know what I'm doing. I like to have a good time, but I like to be in control. I mean, there are times in my life when, after Harry Carl days, I think that I naturally indulged a bit too much as far as what I should have done. I was so unhappy, and life was very, very difficult. But then I stopped because work is work. I never have missed a show. I've missed two shows in 53 years. You cannot dissipate in any way and do your work. I don't think. I don't know how anybody could do it. I certainly couldn't. But I was very proud of Carrie to write a great screenplay. Mm-hmm. And then she wrote These Old Broads last year for Elizabeth and Shirley MacLaine and myself and Joan Collins. That was on television. That was a very funny movie. So I was proud of her for that. She writes all the time. She's at Spielberg, and she works for Mr. Lucas. And she's a, they call them script doctors also, where she mm-hmm. takes a script and is not as funny as it should be, and then she punches it up because she's so funny. She got my sense of humor, Robert.
You have a good relationship with Carrie.
I adore my daughter, yes.
And she adores you.
Well, she does. I mean, we're friends, you know, it's hard. Mother-daughter, especially both of us being in show business.
Yes.
Oh, I think every family has a moment of, especially mothers and daughters. All my girlfriends have had a little problem with when they're young growing up and there's an identity crisis. And my mother and I had problems because my mother wanted to boss me forever and ever, and I certainly didn't like it after a while. But I loved and adored my mother, and if I didn't like what she was saying to me, I'd say, Mother, please don't say that, because we're just not going to get along, and I'm going to leave now. Well, you should leave. Why don't you? I don't want to talk to you anymore. So then I'd go home, because I lived right across the street. I mean, that was always the way it was, and I didn't care. I loved my mother. She was a very strong, powerful lady, and so am I. So I want to tell my daughter if I feel that she's going down a wrong path. I want to warn her. I've gone through a lot of things. And, you know, in this day and age, there's always a financial problem, and sometimes people want to take advantage of you. I've been really creamed in the financial picture, and I don't want my daughter to be hurt financially or any other way. And she's had two big hurts already in her life. And I don't, naturally, parents try to protect their children because we love them so much. So maybe we are a little bit too overly possessive, or perhaps we try to boss our kids too much, but we love them so much. That's the reason.
The catered affair they made with Betty Davis, and she became a great friend of yours. Did you learn a lot from Betty?
Yes, because I told you Richard Brooks was such a difficult director, for some reason didn't like Debbie. And she'd say, come in my room. You know, and I'd go into her room and she'd say, don't pay any attention to silly old, and she'd say a word. Just do your job and always remember to work with the greats and you'll be great. And she taught me how to work with props. You know, we had a big breakfast to cook and a dinner in that movie. And we rehearsed for 2 days. The fish, the potatoes, the vegetables, we had to make it all. She insisted to make all the props so you would match your dialogue with your movement. So for the editor, you were always the same. She was fabulous. She really knew her craft. Uh-huh. So for Betty, who, as you know, always talked like this, and in that picture, she added a New York accent to it.
Uh-huh.
So it's like, I don't know, I can't even do that. It's like a Jackie Mason, you don't want to talk to him. I don't know, you want to make a cookie. So, Betty Davis as a New Yorker.
Uh-huh.
I like to do impressions. Ever since I started in movies, I worked with so many different people, like Ava Gabor. We were doing the movie with Glenn Ford.
Started with a kiss.
It started with a kiss in Spain. And we were sitting out in this big bull ring, and it started to rain. So they all said, go to your dressing rooms. Well, I hadn't met Ava. It was the first day of shooting. And so I went in my dressing room, and I'm just sitting there by myself in the rain in Spain. I think that comes from my
uh-huh.
fair lady.
Or should.
So recognizable. And so I hear a little knock at the door. And there's somebody, it's Ava Gabor. Darling, David, are you in there? I'm so bad at my lonesome in my room. I don't want to be there anymore. Come and let me in. Darling, I can't open the door, sweet, I don't want to by myself. So she comes into my trailer, and we talk all day long. And we talk, and it's getting dark. They forgot us. They left us in the trailer in Spain, out by a bull ring. Outside, nobody came for us. And I said, Ava, I think everybody's gone. And we both get out and we look all, and nobody's there. She said, what are we going to do? I said, and I speak the worst Spanish, but I don't care. I get by, you know what I mean? So I'm running down the street yelling. Finally, we got a car. I said, can we leave? They won't leave us sitting here all by ourselves. I don't believe it. And she was furious. And, you know, Ava could have her, and I love with the accent to be furious. So we were at the Palace Hotel, and she goes, I can't believe your sons are bitches. To all the crew and everybody. They were all at the bar having drinks for hours while we sat in a place. But that's why I started to do, this is Ava, this is her tonage. Darling, how are you, sweetheart? This is Ava, darling. And then it's Mrs. Shasha. Hello, Debbie, darling. I don't know what I, know what I can do for it. One tone higher. She's a little more nervous, I think is what it is. And I worked, of course, I worked, well, I did the Carson show one night, and I did Mae West, because, you know, I do my, because mine is a whole other thing. This is all inside, you know what I mean? You're going to have an attitude. So I was doing Mae West, and I had a red dress on, the whole drag, you know, on the Carson show, and I get home, and the phone is ringing, and it's Mae West. She says, Debbie, I want you to know, I never wear red. I only wear black. Don't ever do it again. Takes up the phone. I never wore red again. Oh, only hookers wear red. She was very upset with me. So I do all these different, and I do Barry Fitzgerald and Liberace, and I do Hepburn. I really do like to do Catherine, whom I adore. So I never do make fun of her. I don't like to do that because she's so brilliant and so great. And I just started working with so many people that had a certain sound that I just put it in my show. You know, to do, I did Pearl Bailey, Phyllis Diller. I'm going to put in Whoopi Goldberg now. I have Dolly Parton in my show. See, I play like, outside of Chicago, I play a theater there in the round outside the Evergreen and Evergreen. And I travel 48 weeks a year, as you know. So I play all these different theaters, and each audience likes something else. So they like a different thing. At one time, I was doing Liza and Judy Garland, with the hair one way on one side and the hair, and I just turn and I'd be Liza, and then I turn and I'd be Judy. That was great fun.
Did you know Judy Garland well?
Very well. I loved her. It was such a sad loss because she was our greatest talent, as is Liza. But Judy was special. You know, I used to live a couple blocks away, and I'd go over, and she'd play her records after work when she was making Star Is Born. I'd put Liza to bed. She was only about 10. Actually, Debbie's was probably about 8. And she'd want to sit on the stairs and listen, and I'd go, you have to go to school tomorrow. And I'd sit in with Judy. And all those terrible stories about Judy, it really makes me furious. When somebody's dead, they wait to say that you're a drunk and you're horrible and terrible. And she wasn't that at all. She loved to party, but, you know, there were problems with diet pills and all that because they tried to get me on that stuff too. At MGM, the doctors always came, gave everybody a shot. And I wouldn't do it because I hate shots. And thank God, you know, and I just, it wasn't something that I wanted to
get. And no one really knew what the result of that was going to be at that point.
They told you it was a vitamin shot.
Yeah.
But it was speed. That happened to Eddie Fisher. There was a man here in New York called Dr. Max Jacobson, Dr. Feelgoods, they called him. And he just got so many great stars and a lot of people in political high places. Again, speed. So it's a very evil, insidious thing to do to people when you lie to them. So anyway, but Judy was a great friend, as was Betty Grable. You knew you loved Betty. I've had such joy meeting all these fabulous people and really being their friends. But Judy, she would play her records and then she'd sing to her record. And I always kid because it's the ones with the hole in the middle, records with the hole in the middle. Now it's DVDs and I can't work anything. I just can't work anything. Can you work those?
I can. Yeah, I can. Not well, but I can. Yeah, I can do that.
I haven't.
Yeah. Well, are you on a computer?
No, I can't do any of that.
Yes, you can.
I'm really like mother in mother. You say I can.
You can.
I want to because I want to learn to email my granddaughter.
I'm always surprised when people, those that do computers and stuff and those that don't, because I would assume immediately you wouldn't let the computer age come in without being a part of it.
I know, but
what's going on at the moment?
I know, I've just been really busy, and I think you have to take lessons and you have to have people over. And when I get home, I'm so tired, I really don't want to have a teacher learning. But I am going to, definitely.
Five years now. You can just do a little bit at a time and look at the end of the tunnel.
Who told you that?
Yeah, I just learned that not too long ago.
I'm going to definitely.
You wrote an advice book back in 1962, 30 years ago.
Can you believe that?
40 years ago. Yikes. And why did you write one then? It's called If I Knew Then.
If I Knew Then. Well, Bob Thomas, the reporter and a columnist, he called me and said, Debbie, I'd like you to write a book with me on, and this was after Eddie and situation like that, and he thought we could do a interesting book. It was, of course, much too soon. What did I know, really? But he really convinced me to do that book, and I enjoyed it. It was. I'm glad I did it because I wrote a second book.
Which is your real autobiography.
My real autobiography, mm-hmm. And it's called My Life. I'm going to redo it now because, of course, it ended that I was happily married and that this was a wonderful man. And wasn't I lucky? Well, how stupid. So I'm going to rewrite it and call it Unsinkable Debbie and do a new ending and a lot of new stories to put to it.
You've always said that you were an extrovert, and you are. Does that help you in show business?
Oh, well, of course, Robert. You are, too, in your sweet, quiet way. Oh. You know, you think you're shy.
Well, I don't think I'm an extrovert, though.
I am. I'm a ham. Mm. Does that mean extrovert?
You know, kind of, yes.
Yes. I'm out there. You know, I'm like Mama Rose, I guess. I'm like Gypsy. I don't know why I'm like that. That's just the way you're born. You really are out there. You really love having it. You like life. You like to taste it. You like to hold it. You like to be in it. You want to experience. You want to smell it and eat it up. And you want to be there. And I've always been like that.
So the second half of the question is, is it ever a disadvantage to be an extrovert in show business?
I don't think at all. I think the only thing you have to be smart enough is to know who's boss and not to take over or try to take over or be boss. If you're not the boss, be an extrovert, but always be sure to be professional and listen to the people that hire you and that have their opinions, and they really have the last word.
Now, I know you can be strong. You're a strong person. You're Aries. Do you think you're tough?
I think you have to be tough to get through life. You don't have to be difficult. You don't have to be obnoxious. But if you're not tough, I don't know how you make it.
Has what's happened to you, has that been a big surprise? We talk about life being what's happening while you're making other plans. Has the fact that there have been so many rough roads and that there's been so many complications when you were just kind of an uncomplicated kid in Burbank, you know, getting this big break at Miss the Burbank contest, and then Warner Brothers and MGM and everything, and all of a sudden, you're also getting splattered along the way with all. Is that a big surprise to you?
I just think it was a big adjustment. You had to grow up very quickly. You had to grow up very fast. One day you're a little girl, and the next day, your name, and a name that is not necessarily unexposed, where people pick on you, and they don't realize that you're just a kid. And they should just let you grow up slowly and not just attack you. I think that was the hardest part. I think that's the hardest part for everyone that's in the business. You know, as you read, people start after little Meg Ryan, this wonderful, talented girl, dates one fellow, and they get on her about this and that. And I know it's heartbreaking to her. And just let people have their life while they have it, and don't try to take their life away from them or injure it. If you love that talent, then respect them and let them breathe and live life. Don't take it away.
What is it about you that you think that we have probably a misconception about you, most people? We all feel we know you and have for years. But what is it about you that perhaps we don't know that we should know about you?
I don't know. I think you should just know everything.
Do you think
about
we know you as you are?
Well, I think through the years, everything's been written about me that can be, and naturally there are things like Eddie Fisher would write that are untrue. But
you objected to his book a lot,
I object to anyone's memory being so poor, and that you should write about anyone that you once loved, and especially the mother of your children. I don't think that that's adult, and I don't think it's something that anyone should do. I just think it's improper behavior. And so, but as far as who am I think you see me, this is who I am. At times I'm Mary Frances Reynolds, my real name, which means I don't want to dress up, I want to stay home, I don't want to fix my hair, I don't want to put on makeup, I just want to sit there and eat my tacos and enchiladas and stay home and hide out, you know, that I'm tired. I work a lot, so I'm sort of a workaholic. I have to stop that. I'm trying to stop that.
Can you?
I'm trying. I'm so used to working so hard from necessity that now I'm in a better position. I don't have to work that hard, and now I can't seem to stop, but I must. And I'm trying to do that because I want to be with my granddaughter more, Billy. And she's so wonderful and funny, and she's going to be 10. And I don't want to miss any more years. I want to be with Billy and my daughter, Carrie, and my son, Todd. And I love my brother. So I want to be more with my family and my friends. I haven't gone out to dinner like maybe in 20 years to dinner, just to dinner. That's ridiculous, Debbie. So I have to change. I have to learn how to enjoy the life while I have it. I'm trying to do that. But as far as the public knowing about me, this is what I am. This is what I'm not different than this.
Your daughter said one of the greatest things she learned about you was the fact that you never mark time. You either do it full out, do it 100%, or don't do it at all.
That's true. That's a good line, and it is the true line. I don't know halfway. I don't think you start something you can't finish. I don't think you ever begin that. If you begin something, finish it. Do it really well. Give it your all. Drop dead doing it if you have to. Just do it really well.
If we're sitting here 10 years from now talking, and I hope we are, what would you like to have happen?
Through a great gauze.
What? Not necessary.
A great skim.
What would you like to have happen in the next 10 years?
I'd like to be here in the next 10 years. I'd like to be in life. I'd like to go through life. Another 10 years would be a great gift. I would be most grateful for that, just to be here. To accomplish more, I didn't think I would accomplish what I have with the help of many. I've been very blessed coming through the golden years of show business. There would be no Debbie Reynolds if it weren't for film, and I've been very, very lucky. So I just hope now my life can be as it should be, with my family and content. No more problems, no more husbands, and straight ahead, be in show business, which I adore, and stay healthy.
Thanks, Debbie.
Thanks, Robert.